well be a candidate for president who could win a majority of Palestinian votes. I think the other issue, and there are other possibilities as far as hostages are concerned. For example, release of all the civilian hostages in exchange for a certain number of prisoners. And I have no idea where that negotiation is going. Some Israeli press reports indicate that the Israeli government is talking about progress when there hasn't actually been progress in order to decrease the pressure of hostage families who are demanding the release of Palestinian prisoners in order to get their loved ones home. I think the broader question,
especially after Israel killed three of the hostages from Israel.
Accidentally, exactly, yes. And many others apparently have been killed in the bombing, and released hostages have said, we were terrified for our lives because of the bombing that was going on. I've read accounts in the Israeli press from released hostages who've talked about how the kind of danger that they were in, not so much from their captors as from the possibility that they would be killed by the Israeli bombardments. The other aspect of this is the political aspect. Hamas has a position in Palestinian politics that is not going to be eradicated, no matter what Israel does in Gaza. If Israel entirely defeats Hamas's entire military network of infrastructure, if it kills every single fighter, these are, of course, probably unrealistic, but even assuming that they can do that, Hamas continues as a political movement. Hamas continues to have support among Palestinians, not majority support, according to almost every poll I've ever seen, but a certain amount of support. When the Palestinians manage to put together a government, and, you know, everybody else is going to try and do it for them. The United States is going to try and impose its intentions on them. The Israeli government will undoubtedly try and do the same, and the Europeans, in their colonial way, will probably try and do the same, telling the Palestinians what's good for them and telling them who they can have and not have in their government. But when and if the Palestinians can get their own act together and form some kind of, for example, reformed PLO, there is no way to exclude Hamas from that. This idea that Hamas, because of what it did on October 7th, is completely excluded from Palestinian governance is a fantasy, an Israeli-American European fantasy. You do not negotiate with the people who have already agreed to your terms. You couldn't do that in Ireland. You had to bring the IRA in. You couldn't do that in South Africa. You had to bring the ANC in. You couldn't do that in Algeria. You had to bring the FLN in. These are groups that had carried out horrific attacks, in many cases, on civilians. These are groups that were described by the colonial power in South Africa, in Algeria, in Ireland, as terrorists or bandits, or they had different terms at different times. But the only people you really need to negotiate with are the people with the guns, after all. And until that fact gets through the thick skulls of people in Washington and in Paris and London, we're not going anywhere. They can pick Quislings, they can pick technocrats, they can select the Palestinians who are acceptable to them, who meet whatever test, who get down on their knees and condemn Hamas, or whatever litmus test is imposed. And those people will represent nobody, will have no credibility, will have no legitimacy, and will have no control over the situation. And so you are looking, barring an acceptance that you have to eventually deal with your real enemies, you are looking at a situation of unending Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, direct or indirect. You are looking at a situation which implies unending resistance to that occupation. How many people can they kill? If Israel claims that there are 25 or 30,000 militants, armed militants in Hamas, how many of them can they kill? 10, 12, 11, 15? There will eventually be others. People who are still there. And that means that an imposed solution, with Israel continuing to operate in the Gaza Strip, which it has said it intends to do, will provoke continued resistance. So nothing will be solved, and the reconstruction and the end of the misery of the people of Gaza can't take place until those kinds of changes, from occupation to some kind of Palestinian governance, takes place. And I don't see, you read the Washington Post, David Ignatius, the idea that Arab countries are going to go in and do Israel and the United States' dirty work for them is a fantasy. The Emiratis and the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Jordanians will not go in and govern on behalf of Israel. It is not going to happen. There has to be Palestinian governance of Palestinian territories. And that is going to have to, one way or another, involve all the groups within the Palestinian political spectrum. The Palestinians have been divided by their own, you know, for reasons that have to do with Palestinian dysfunction, but they've also been divided by the divide and rule policies of the United States, Israel, and the Europeans. As long as that continues, this festering sore will continue, and there will be violence, and it will not only be violence caused by hard men in Hamas, it'll be violence caused by the horrors visited on the Palestinians by 56 years of occupation, by 75 years of colonialism, and the fact that people inevitably, necessarily resist occupation. They have to come to terms sooner or later with the fact, in Washington and in Israel, with the fact that Palestinian governance is a matter to be decided by Palestinians. And that is simply not in the mindset, if you read what comes out of Washington or what comes out of Israel, of our government or Israeli government or many European governments.
Professor, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, you said that there's an unquestionable connection of Judaism and the Jewish people to the Holy Land, and yet that Israel, the Israeli state, is a settler colonial project. And in your L.A. Times piece recently, you called it the assault on Gaza, the last colonial war of the modern age. Could you elaborate?
Right. Sure. I mean, this goes back to the nature of Zionism. Zionism is a national project, which distinguishes it from every other settler colonial movement, project. But at the same time, it was a self-identified colonial project. I mean, the Jewish Colonization Agency, the Palestinian Jewish Colonization Agency, is the term that organization, which existed until 1958, applied to itself. That was something that was accepted by early Zionist leaders. They argued they had a claim to the Holy Land. There's a connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. All of this is true, that there is such an attachment and such a connection. But Zionism is a European colonial project backed by imperialism, British imperialism, and which intended to replace an indigenous population with a Jewish population. As Zev Jabotinsky said, we want to transform Palestine into the land of Israel. And that meant a demographic transformation, and that meant a dispossession of the population and theft of their land, as happens in every settler colonial scenario. So Israel is both the result of a national project, Zionism, and the result of a settler colonial project. You can walk and chew gum at the same time. There's actually no contradiction between it. And it's unique in that it was not just an extension of a mother country's population and sovereignty. It had its own independent ambitions to establish a Jewish state, not a British state. Came in under the protection of Britain, but it had its own aims, separate, independent aims. So it's a unique phenomenon in the modern world. And it learned everything it did from the British. The Israeli army's earliest leaders were trained by British colonial counterinsurgency specialists to blow up houses over the heads of their residents, to shoot prisoners, to attack villages at night. This is British counterinsurgency, which was transmitted to Israeli members of the Palmach and the Haganah in the 1930s in order for them to help the British fight the Palestinians. And those are the founders of the Israeli army. Moshe Dayan was trained by British counterinsurgency specialists. Yigal Alon, Yitzhak Sadeh, well, many of the leading figures in what became the Israeli army have that training. And Israel is using laws left over, the 1945 Defense Emergency Regulations, under which people are put in administrative detention. No indictment, no trial, no conviction, nothing. They're just put in jail and kept there. That's a British 1945 emergency regulation. That's a typical colonial instrument. So this is a colonial war fought in order to maintain the supremacy of this group, which has taken the country over, at the expense of the indigenous Palestinian population. The connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is, in my view, incontrovertible. But that in and of itself doesn't justify the colonial methods that have been used in the establishment and the maintenance of Israel's supremacy over now the entirety of Palestine, from the river to the sea.
Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said, Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including The 100 Years' War on Palestine. We'll link to your opinion piece for the L.A. Times, headlined How the U.S. Has Fueled Israel's Decades-Long War on Palestinians. Coming up, we look at how a group of Palestinian Christians are trapped in the Holy Family Church in Gaza, where a mother and daughter were shot dead this weekend by an Israeli sniper. Stay with us.
While sitting on a crowded southbound train, it happened just the other day. I could have sworn that I was rolling back as the train beside me slowly pulled away. Well, my whole life long, it seems I've been on that track, with everybody rolling on and me just slipping back. And they don't wave goodbye and they don't look back, so I guess I've gotta keep on keeping on. Some people always
keep on keeping on by Len Chandler. The song by the folk singer who passed away this year was later quoted in a speech by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It is terrorism. Those were the words of Pope Francis after an Israeli sniper shot dead two Christian women, an elderly woman and her adult daughter, who tried to save her at a Catholic church in Gaza City on Sunday. The shooting took place at the Holy Family Latin Parish, where scores of Palestinian Christians have been trapped with little food or water. The Pope condemned the shooting in remarks Sunday.
And let us not forget our brothers and sisters suffering from war in Ukraine, Palestine, Israel, and other conflict zones. May the approach of Christmas strengthen our commitment to open paths of peace. I continue to receive from Gaza very serious and painful news. Unarmed civilians are being bombed and shot at. And this has even happened inside the Holy Family Parish compound, where there are no terrorists, but families, children, and sick people with disabilities, and nuns. A mother and her daughter, Miss Nahida Khalil Antan, and her daughter, Samar Kamal Antan, were killed and others wounded by the snipers as they went to the bathroom. The house of Mother Teresa's nuns was damaged. Their generator hit. Some say it's terrorism. It's war. Yes, it's war. It's terrorism. That is why Scripture says that God stops war, breaks bows, and breaks spears. Let us pray to the Lord for peace.
That was the Pope this Sunday. British MP Leila Moran has also denounced Israel's attacks on the Gaza City Catholic Church. Some of her relatives are trapped inside.
I've spoken before in this house about my extended family who are in the Holy Family Parish Church in Zeytun in Gaza. And the situation has been desperate for weeks, but now it's descending. There are tanks outside the gates, there are soldiers and snipers pointing into the complex, shooting at anyone who ventures out. And the convent was bombed. On Saturday, two women were shot. They were simply trying to get to the toilet. There is no electricity, there is no clean water, and the update that I had last night was that they're down to their last can of corn. I'm told, after pressure, that food has been delivered, but they've not seen it. And when this began a week ago, the IDF soldiers ordered these civilians to evacuate against their will. Can the government confirm that it sees the forcible displacement of civilians as unacceptable?
Yeah.
The people in this church, Mr. Speaker, are civilians. They have nothing to do with Hamas. They are nuns, orphans, disabled people. They are a small Christian community, and they know everyone. As the Pope has said, and my family can confirm, it is categorically untrue to say Hamas are operating from there. This situation has been condemned by many. Will this government do so?
We're joined now by Philip Farah. He is a co-founder of the Palestinian Christian Alliance for Peace, has relatives sheltering in the Church of St. Porphyrius in Gaza City, which has also come under attack. Last month, one of his relatives, Elham Farah, who is a beloved 84-year-old music teacher, daughter of a famed Palestinian poet, was killed by an Israeli sniper outside the Holy Family Church, where the mother and daughter were killed on Sunday by an Israeli sniper. Philip Farah, can you describe what is happening there right now and talk about this small Palestinian Christian community under siege? How is this happening?
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Democracy Now! Yes, three of my grandparents are from Gaza. I was raised in Jerusalem, but we had very strong connections to Gaza. There were many, many Palestinian Christian families in Gaza. It was a thriving community. Our relatives, the Madbaks, the Tarazis, the Sabas, the Jahshan, Farah, including Farah and Saigh, were a thriving community that lived in peace with their Muslim neighbors. And even there were Jewish neighbors. Back then, one of my grand uncles was a grains merchant, and some of his best friends were Jewish grains merchants as well. They were in the business of exporting barley, actually, to the United Kingdom for upgrading beer in breweries in the UK. Over the years, that community has dwindled to a tiny minority because of the horrible conditions that Israel has imposed on Gaza. Especially back in 2013, the number was 3,000, far, far smaller than it was, say, at the turn of the century. Now it's only barely 1,000 people, and they're all sheltering in St. Porphyrius, the Orthodox Church. That is the church where my father, uncles and aunts, and members of my extended family were baptized. So many were sheltering in St. Porphyrius. I think still some are. Four of my Tarazi relatives were killed there. Ilham actually was sheltering at St. Porphyrius until the bombing that killed, the Israeli bombing that killed 18 Christians in that church. And then she moved to the Holy Cross, the Holy Family Church. She was a delightful 84-year-old woman, beloved of many students in Gaza. But she was strong-headed. And against the advice of her fellows who were sheltering there, she wanted to go home. She just simply wanted to go home. And she proceeded to do that. A sniper shot her in the leg. And folks who were trying to rescue her were all being shot at, so she bled to death. What could a woman like that, 84-year-old woman, have done to hurt Israelis? Or so, you know, this is a continuing saga. Now the vast majority are sheltering in the Church of the Holy Family, and as you said, the snipers have shot two other elderly, Nahida, an elderly woman, and her daughter came to carry her, and she was shot and killed. And seven others were also injured. I have a relative by the name of Philip Jahshan. Actually, my family originally was Jahshan. Philip Jahshan is the only Gazan whom I'm able to reach through social media. He's sheltering there. I was worried about him and tried to reach him, but communications was shut down. I was able to, he told me that he was okay, but like you said, they have no food, and as you know, Israel has used water and food and electricity as part of its genocidal war. There's no other name for it.
Philip, we want to continue this conversation after the broadcast, and we're going to post it online. Philip Farah is co-founder of the Palestinian Christian Alliance for Peace. has relatives sheltering in the Church of St. Porphyrius in Gaza City, which was bombed by the Israeli military. Porphyrius is thought to be the third oldest church in the world. Last month, his family member, Elham Farah, was killed by an Israeli sniper outside the Holy Family Church, where she had been taking refuge. Next up, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has signed one of the nation's most extreme anti-immigrant bills, empowering local police to arrest anyone they suspect of entering the United States without authorization. Back in 20 seconds. Mexican band Mint Fueled. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Senate leaders say President Biden will have to wait until next year to negotiate a deal with Republicans on immigration as part of an emergency funding package for Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan and more. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, the leading Republican candidate in next year's presidential race, doubled down on his hateful comments about immigrants at a campaign event a Tuesday in Iowa when he paraphrased the Nazi dictator Adolf Hitler as he spoke between two Christmas trees.
It's crazy what's going on. They're ruining our country, and it's true. They're destroying the blood of our country. That's what they're doing. They're destroying our country. They don't like it when I said that, and I never read Mein Kampf.
Hitler used the phrase blood poisoning in Mein Kampf to argue German blood was being, quote, poisoned by Jews. Trump drew outrage for similar comments at a rally Saturday in New Hampshire. This comes as Texas Governor Greg Abbott, major Trump supporter, approved a sweeping new law, just signed it into law, that allows police to arrest anyone they suspect to have entered the U.S. without authorization. For more, we're joined by Marisa Limon Garza, executive director of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, which is part of the lawsuit to stop the new Texas law from going into effect in March. Her op-ed for the Messenger is headlined, "The Senate Shouldn't Treat Migrants as Bargaining Chips." Marisa, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's start with the law that the governor signed in the last few days, the significance of what this means and why even local police chiefs are against this in Texas.
So Senate Bill 4 here in the state of Texas is part of legislation that the governor has been pushing since the regular session. This was just the end of the fourth special session, specifically to push on school vouchers, public education, as well as on this anti-immigrant racist policy. This is built off of the knowledge of what happened with Arizona and SB 1070, the Show Me Your Papers law there, and it's a little more slippery. It finds loopholes that are able to make it so that any peace officer anywhere in the state of Texas, not just along the southern border, but anywhere, and very loosely defined, if this peace officer has probable cause, they can make the determination that if a person has not crossed into Texas from Mexico at an official U.S. port of entry, they can then be detained, jailed, and even deported. Obviously, this is the jurisdiction of the federal government, which is why we're calling on the Department of Justice to immediately get involved. And yes, Las Americas, along with American Gateways, our partners at the El Paso County and the ACLU, are in litigation against SB 4 and its rollout.
And Marisa, you've written that your office had received a staggering number of calls, up to 7,000 a day, from asylum seekers in Ciudad Juarez. How do you see the situation now, especially those Americans who say that the situation at the border is completely out of control?
So I just like to paint a picture. You know, the reality at the southern border is we have been seeing a small piece of what is global migration. So this phenomenon is 110 million people forcibly displaced across the globe, according to UN statistics for the month of September. And so this is just one pedacito of that reality. It's important also to recognize that the state of Texas is, in fact, you know, a multiracial democracy. It just happens to be one that is severely oppressed. And this attempt at erasure really makes things a lot more complicated. We have to take that into context, along with the reality that Texas has very lax gun laws, the reality that Texas does not really make it easy for people to vote, does not provide a quality education for the young people of this state. We're focused on banning books. We're focusing on eliminating diversity, equity, inclusion at public universities. So it's basically the silencing and the erasure of a people. And that cannot go uncontested. And if we, again, zoom out, we know that this global migration, and specifically the people that we're seeing along the U.S.-Mexico border, reflect global migration, but it also reflects U.S. involvement around the globe, but particularly in Central and South America, whether it's destabilization during the Obama administration, whether it's further back. There are U.S. fingerprints all over the migrants that we see at the southern border. Our work is to accompany. So we do that as folks reach out to us, whether it's from Tapachula, Querétaro, Mexico City, to Ciudad Juarez. We accompany people across the port, and then we accompany people in the U.S. detention settings, as well as in our community. And we like to do as warm handoffs as possible to folks in the interior. And it's important to recognize that actually USCIS is doing a phenomenal job of a new program where they are co-locating with us at the southern border in San Diego, El Paso, and Brownsville, to make sure that people, migrants who use CBP-1, the application that this administration has put forward as the tool that should be used, if they come through that app and they come to one of the shelters that's offering the service, they will be able to leave our community with a work authorization. That means that when they get to Chicago, New York, LA, wherever, they will rely much less on the social safety nets of those communities and will begin to have a dignified life as they go through their asylum claims.
And we have about a minute left, but could you talk about the response of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus to the Biden administration, basically not even consulting them in terms of its decisions on negotiations for another $14 billion in border security money that the president is requesting?
Yes, we were all duped. You know, we've been involved in conversations with the Biden administration since they were the transition team. I personally have hosted Secretary Mayorkas in our office. I sat next to the vice president when she was here. Our local bishop welcomed President Biden and spent several minutes with him in private. They know our reality, and they know that these leaders of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus represent us, and they're not being quiet. They're being quite loud, and the fact that they're not even being given the respect of a seat at the table is a further slap in the face of everything that we're trying to accomplish and the representation that we have. None of the Senate negotiators are people of color. The one senator who is a person from a borderland state is Kristen Sinema from Arizona. She does not live near the border. Our two senators here in Texas, Ted Cruz and Senator Cornyn, do not have offices in El Paso. If you go to their website, it says contact us, but they have them everywhere else. And so it's very clear that we are under attack. It's very clear from the language of the previous president and from our governor, who's interested in being his running mate, that we have targets on our backs. And we in El Paso, along with people in Uvalde and all across the country, know that when you mix that kind of rhetoric with gun laws that we have and policies and laws like SB4, it's a very dangerous cocktail.
Marisa Limon Garza, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. We're going to link to your piece in The Messenger, The Senate Shouldn't Treat Migrants as Bargaining Chips. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Aguster, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.